Hi, on RN, Lynn Malcolm here with All in the Mind. Today, being on the spectrum. How did Thomas Kuzma feel about being diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when he was 16?
This is why I always mention the dark years as my high school years. It always felt like there was nothing, nowhere. Everything was darkness. Asperger's, to me, felt like a light being shut upon me, like, I don't know, some kind of big beam coming down saying, this is what makes you you. And I finally found something out about me that I could be proud of. At the same time, I was watching a show called Boston Legal, which had an Asperger's character in it. And I watched this one episode where I saw him fighting for the little guy. And that's what I told myself. This is what I'm going to be. I'm going to be Thomas Kuzma, the guy who defends the little Aspie guys and help them exceed in life. So I go around talking about Asperger's syndrome.
For Thomas, identifying with the Asperger's label is important, as you can hear. This month, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, often referred to as the Psychiatrist's Bible, is to release its updated version, the DSM-5. You may have heard some of the controversies around the new edition. It will eliminate Asperger's syndrome as a separate category and merge it into the new classification of autism spectrum disorders. Despite many research efforts, we still don't know much about the causes or the specific genes which cause autism, and we also know little about the potential risk factors. But the prevalence appears to be increasing. Nicole Reinhardt is Professor of Clinical Psychology at Deakin University and has practiced in paediatrics for 15 years.
10 years ago, we looked at the prevalence. We were talking about, you know, 5 in 10,000 children, and now we're looking at around 1 in 150, with some figures suggesting as high as 1 in 88 children. So what's happened, particularly since the diagnosis of Asperger's disorders come into our clinical diagnostic manuals, is we've started to understand autism in a broader way. So we've started to understand children who are normally intelligent, have very good verbal skills, but still have difficulties in the area of social communication and stereotyped repetitive behaviour patterns. So we're understanding that end of the spectrum better. And we're also understanding the other end of the spectrum, children who are described as having low functioning autism. So with this broader understanding, more children are being diagnosed, and that's what's explaining the high prevalence.
Benison O'Reilly has 3 sons, one of whom was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3. Since then, she's learned a lot about the condition and has written the Australian Autism Handbook. She describes some of her son's symptoms. Firstly, his self-stimulating behaviour, referred to as stimming.
Actually, it's probably my least favourite aspect, and my son has a few of these. So he likes to line things up. He loves colours and things like that, so he'll get cards and line them up. I mean, the other ones that are more common are the hand flapping, which often is a sign of excitement. The worst ones, of course, are things like when they actually do sort of self-injury and hit themselves, but that's obviously very distressing for the parents. And early on, he had the echolalia, you know, when they repeat phrases, and that's also regarded as a verbal stim. So a lot of his early language was actually just repeating video scripts, and some children, like, learn the entire script of a video and can repeat it. We all have stims, but people with autism, it's usually more obvious. And I guess because they're not socially aware, they don't really care that they look odd, because that's sometimes I say to my son, I say, you know, if you do that, people will think you're odd. But I don't think he still cares, really. And maybe that's a good thing to be.
He also has motor symptoms connected with his condition.
Yes, problems around low muscle tone, but also things like motor planning, knowing where your body is in space. And he still hasn't learned to tie his shoes. That's the one that most things we've worked on. We've got him riding bikes and swimming and all that sort of thing, but the tying the shoes is a bit of a bridge too far, and it's a bit of a problem with him starting high school next year. Obviously, it's wiring in the brain that's affected as well, so it's not just the social aspects. But you've probably also heard about the sensory aspects of autism, and that's another change in the new DSM 5 that they brought that in as a diagnostic criteria. They can either be oversensitive or undersensitive to senses like sounds or touch. So you can have children that won't wear particular clothes because they scratch. And you or I wouldn't understand, but for them it feels intolerable. And also sounds, that they will hear sounds that you and I can't hear, and they're really distracting. Fluorescent lights is another one. So it's really important that the school learn more about this condition, because I think a lot of children come cropper in school with a lack of understanding that these are not them being difficult. It's because it's really distressing for them.
And what are the sensory aspects that your son experiences?
He used to be very sensitive to sounds. There were some sounds he just couldn't tolerate. For me, they were pretty horrible sounds as well, like vacuum cleaners and those leaf blowers and things like that. But he would, like, sort of run screaming out of the room. He's not too bad, I think, compared to some people I know who have huge problems around this area. You know, even high-functioning people with Asperger's, it's still a big thing for them. I guess another one that you quite often have is kids hate supermarkets and things like that, so they'll tantrum in supermarkets.
Yeah, so tantruming is not uncommon, is it?
No. Quite often they think it's related to communication. If you can't communicate what's wrong and you're distressed, well, the only way you can get someone's attention in that situation is to sort of lash out. So parents might refer to it as a meltdown. I think that's one of the worst times when I was young. You know, my son was young and I was in the supermarket or something, and he'd have a huge meltdown. So I'd have to drag him kicking and screaming out of the supermarket with people looking at me. It's a very distressing experience.
So in terms of helping him with social skills, to what extent have you been able to help him and teach him to improve his social skills?
Well, he had 2 years of intensive early intervention, and that took him from being a child that was, like, fairly difficult to control with virtually no language to being a child that had language and knew some of the social rules, and you could attend preschool and not always compliant, but then no 4-year-old boy is necessarily always compliant. What it didn't bridge is that sort of desire for friendship and things like that. And so we did a lot of play dates, but they were quite structured and, I guess, artificial is the word I'd say. So over the years, what we've done with him is challenge him. We thought, well, we'll have to put up with difficult situations, but make him sure that he is capable of going out in community. A couple of years ago, he developed a few anxiety things which were having a problem at school, so I took him to a psychologist, and so now he sees a psychologist once a fortnight, and she actually sort of specifically does social skills, so she talks to him about the necessary things of a conversation, about the back and forth and about why it's polite to say hello and goodbye and look at people and things like that. It's very structured and very rule-based, but it just makes him sort of fit into the community more. And I've actually been quite encouraged by the changes there with him, but it's quite an artificial thing. But if you fit in society, it does help. That's reality.
Thomas Kuzma was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome as a teenager. As a young adult, he's learnt some social skills along the way.
I have found out many things about people. I've learnt things like body language and facial expressions. I have learnt things like empathy through friends and through what I have seen through other people. So when it comes to relationships, I have done my best to think about the other person, not just think about myself.
Is that hard to do?
It has been a struggle at times when it comes to, like, dating. Like, I've had some of the worst dating. I've had some of the best dating experiences. But I've learned things like do not make too much eye contact or too little eye contact. I have learned that if someone says no, don't keep talking about the same thing on and on again.
Some people with Asperger's have trouble with being really sensitive to outside stimulus. Do you have any of that experience?
There have been a couple of instances where I've had sensory overload. I had this filming job where I was filming a pub crawl. There were many drunk people there. Because it was in the summer, the heat was just way too intense. I had people pushing me and pulling me, going, film me, film me. And I thought the job was going to be something small. This turned out to be something that took over an entire town. And it just broke me. I could not work for a good 2 months, I could not go outside. It was very, very hard.
So what are the things that you have learnt that you can do for yourself to calm yourself or to make yourself feel better?
Well, when I'm about to have a meltdown where everything's just overwhelming, I need to find somewhere nice and quiet. I get my iPad out, I get a bottle of water, and I listen to some smooth jazz whilst just drinking on something that's like a nice cold glass of water. It helps.
Thomas learnt some of his coping skills by doing an orientation and transition course at TAFE in Western Sydney. It's designed to help people like him cope with further study. You're listening to All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia and online. I'm Lynn Malcolm. One reason why the DSM-5 now defines autism as being a spectrum of disorders, ranging from mild through to severe, is that there's no definitive evidence that clearly distinguishes between Asperger's syndrome and autism. Clinical psychologist Nicole Reinhardt's research has been tracking children with autism and Asperger's disorder for over a decade, and her latest focus is on the children's walking patterns and what they can tell us about brain differences. So what's her take on the new definition?
Just to put it into historical perspective, so DSM-4 introduced Asperger's disorder, so that was 1994. We've had this very small window of time where researchers have had the opportunity to look at children with these different presentations and to understand them. And so we've been engaged in some of that science and using motor paradigms to look at the differences. And we did that on the basis of clinical observation of children with autism versus Asperger's disorder and noting that they have different motor patterns. So that's where the research started. And where it's gone is we've been using a number of gait paradigms to more closely look at the walking patterns. And those walking patterns we've found to be quite different in the two groups of children. In particular, children with autism have what we call more of a cerebellar type of gait. They're more bouncy, they have more difficulty walking on a straight line. And we don't see that bouncy, cerebellar, irregular gait in children with Asperger's disorder. So that tells us that there are probably differences in the area of the brain between these two groups. So the cerebellum is involved in movement and ensuring that movement is smooth and coordinated. And when we see patterns of movement that are irregular of this particular type, it gives us a clue that this part of the brain's involved. So we've got that from the motor studies, but there's been numerous brain imaging studies which have actually looked at this part of the brain more closely and shown that there are structural differences.
So this work shows that diagnostically you can distinguish between Asperger's and autism according to their walking patterns.
Well, this research will take a long time to get to the end of the pipeline with something that we can say, look, we've looked at 1,000 children and we're able to say that this type of presentation is consistent with Asperger's and this type of presentation is more consistent with autism.
So what could the benefit, though, be of establishing that Asperger's and autism are quite distinct?
At the end of the day, these are labels, and the labels are useful because they can point to different treatments that can be useful for children who have different types of presentations. So just as an example, with some of the motor research we're doing, it might say, well, look, if you've got autism, then this type of intervention at this time, tailored to this targeted symptom area, is going to help these children. If you've got a child with Asperger's disorder, this type of motor intervention is going to be useful. And so it can help in clinical decision making. But at the end of the day, it's about understanding the child's strengths and weaknesses and tailoring treatments to a particular child. So I think we do get a bit hung up on labels. But as a clinician, when I'm sitting in a room with a child, I'm not sitting there thinking, well, you've got, autism, so this is the recipe book for autism versus Asperger's disorder. It's about understanding the child, their experience of the symptoms, and how they're interfering.
So what effective management and treatment of the autism spectrum disorders is now available?
There are a lot of interventions around that are based on excellent clinical backgrounds and experience, but we need more evidence-based research in this area, because where we don't have evidence base, that opens up gaps for therapies to come onto the market that look good and look glossy but mightn't necessarily be helpful. And if you're a parent of a child with autism, you'll try anything and you'll go anywhere. And so research and evidence-based therapies need to be the mainstay and need to be available. They need to be federally funded, because if we don't, then glossy shop fronts will open up offering parents hope with interventions that aren't based on evidence, and that's a danger.
So what we're seeing now from the observation room is one example of a group activity that we're doing within the Early Start Denver model program that we're implementing here at the Community Children's Center Autism Program at La Trobe University.
Dr. Giacomo Vivanti is conducting a research program at the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre using what's known as the Early Start Denver model. There's strong evidence that this model of intervention leads to significant positive changes. So what does it involve?
Well, for example, we had one little boy coming here every day, basically, since August 2010. And it was a child who was, as many children with autism are, unable and apparently not interested in doing things with other children. He will learn a number of things by himself through interactions with objects, but showing very low ability to do things with others. So this is what we're doing here for a child like him, is to make sure that learning happens with other people, that learning is about how other children and how adults interact and use language and communication.
So I can see him here at the moment, and he was over playing somewhere else, and the staff member came and they're continually trying to bring him back to be with the other kids.
Yes, our role here is to facilitate participation of children into activities that are relevant for learning, and in particular a specific process that we call social learning, which is learning from people. One of the main target, and this is what you're seeing here, is turn taking, waiting for your turn, understanding that activity is based on a number of different people participating to the activity and having different roles for different children and waiting for your turn. It means taking into account the existence of other children.
So they're waiting for a turn to have a go on this equipment.
Yeah, and as you can see, we have some children who need some support for that, but there are other children who are waiting for their turn. And this is what we've been learning about these children in these 2 years, is that some children learn quickly and some other children need significant support and tend to learn very slowly. And we're trying to understand why, because it's really hard to tell at the beginning why some children are so responsive to this kind of play-based routines, while some other children are not.
It's a very intensive process, because I can see on the right here where the child is having his turn on the play equipment. There are two people attending to him and his reactions to how he's going there. And over on the left, we've got the kids waiting for their turn, sitting on chairs, and there are three people there attending to their needs, helping them, supporting them to wait.
Yes. This is one of the many things that we had to negotiate in terms of having the resources to create these kind of activities. This is a group-based program, so it's not a one-on-one, and community center wouldn't have the resources to have a one-on-one intensive program. So what we're doing is to make sure that we have enough staff to cover different areas, and attention is given when it's necessary for the child to participate into the activity. However, the staff does not, as you can see, completely direct the activity. The organization that you see is to provide children cues about what they're supposed to do. It's a process that will be very easy with typically developing children, but with children with autism who don't have this spontaneous tendency to do things together in a cooperative way, it requires a very specific organization and a quite intense attention to the activity.
Dr. Giacomo Vivanti. This research is to assess the effectiveness and sustainability of the intervention in a group setting and to understand why it works better for some children than others. But it's widely agreed that early intervention has the potential to make the most difference for children with an autism spectrum disorder. Even though Thomas Kuzma has improved his social skills since he was first diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at 16, life is still challenging for him, even when it comes to getting a job.
The problem with me with working is that whenever I mention Asperger's, if they don't understand Asperger's, they might think that I'm making up some kind of excuse. Now, I'm a person who presents really well for someone who has Asperger's syndrome. And when people see that, they think, oh, this guy's just, you know, he's making up excuses, he doesn't really want to work. And I'm like, no, I would like to work in this field. I have the skills. And I've got the experience as well. And unfortunately, many times I haven't received the job itself.
In what areas of your life do you feel that you need most help now?
I've had my fair share of organizational and time management skills, but when it comes to coming to a new place, that tends to muck it up a little bit. And because I'm trying to get used to something new, I usually need someone who is there for when I start. If they can introduce me to all the things, show me when things are due on time and how things are to be presented, that's where I need the most support. I can get many jobs done and on time, but if I'm given too little notice, then it's like going uphill. Other than that, I'm a bright, bubbly person who anyone would love to have me employed. Yeah.
The difficulties that Thomas still faces as an adult with Asperger's highlights the worry that Nicole Reinhardt has about the changes to the criteria in the new DSM-5 guidelines.
There's a study done showing that up to 30%, I think, of children who are currently diagnosed with Asperger's disorder might not meet the new criteria. So the concern is that not all children with Asperger's disorder will be diagnosed. I don't want to be alarmist about it, because at the end of the day, when DSM-5 comes in, if I see a child who very clearly presents with what we know now as Asperger's disorder, then I'm almost certain that that term is going to remain in our use clinically, because it is very useful clinically. It provides a language to describe a particular presentation that might not be captured in DSM-5.
And I guess another downside of seeing Asperger's as a milder form of autism might mean that the discomfort and disruption to people's lives who are diagnosed as having Asperger's may not be acknowledged as easily.
Yes, absolutely. This idea of having some milder form is a misnomer, because the reality is, just because you're very bright and very articulate, if you're having significant difficulties reading and coping in social situations and your behaviour is inflexible and you have a great need for routine and can't go with the flow, life is going to be very challenging and you're going to need a lot of support in that. And people mightn't understand. So we always have to keep in mind, again, labels aside, that one person is different from another person with autism or with Asperger's disorder, and we need to maintain that vigilance around understanding them as complex neurodevelopmental disorders and try not to put people in neat boxes.
So how does Thomas Kuzma see his future?
Well, my ultimate dream would be to create my own TV show or cartoon, to create something that is like mine, something that could speak to all Aspies, for them to have somewhere to go or someone to look up to. maybe like I had a fictional character to look up to. To give that to someone who, like a 10 years younger version of myself, that would be fantastic. As for family goals, just for my family to be happy. Like, I don't want to stress my dad out too much about this whole Aspie thing. He's become much more aware. Back when we first found out, Dad was a little bit worried. But as time has gone on, he has become more welcoming. He's found out it's not a disability, but more like a gift. Because every Aspergian, every person with all kinds of mental conditions, they've got gifts that should be celebrated in the world.
And what of Benison O'Reilly's 12-year-old son, who was diagnosed with autism when he was 3? Overall, is he a happy boy?
Yes, I can tell you that he is actually really happy. And as I say, he doesn't really care that he doesn't have friends. He has things that make him happy. He's very good at computers. So at this stage, he's happy. I would love that to remain that way. It's probably the most important thing for me. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see.
And what about your relationship with him and I guess how it's affected you over time to be his mother?
Oh, I just adore him. I say this to people, it's like, it's something about his vulnerability. I don't know that I'm really close to him. My husband is as well. But also, I think you wouldn't understand if we had them. You know, I always thought that the child that was less perfect would be, you'd think might be less lovable. But actually, when it comes the other way, I actually have struggled to not love him more. And I have two beautiful other sons, and of course I adore them. But it's something about him. It's a very profound love. And I think a lot of people who have children with disabilities would understand that regardless of the disability. I guess it's almost that there's an unconditional love in a way, and because they're a little bit vulnerable, you're more protective. And so I feel really sensitive about him. It's like having the top layer of my skin peeled off with him. I'm so sensitive about him. And I have to remind myself that, you know, some of the slights that I think are happening, he doesn't notice that they're my problem, really. Like, you know, being like, because he has, the autism is actually quite protective from that, the way he misses a lot of things that I pick up. But, yeah. And so obviously 9 years ago when I got the diagnosis, I thought it was like the worst thing in the world. And if he didn't have autism, that would be better for him. But, you know, it's actually had some positive effects on my life as well.
Benison O'Reilly, co-author with Catherine Wicks of the Australian Autism Handbook. Go to the All in the Mind website for more details about what you've heard today, abc.net.au/radionational, and choose All in the Mind in the list. Love you to make a comment on the site too. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to the All in the Mind podcast so you don't miss an episode. But before I go, All in the Mind is offering you the chance to win one of 10 gold passes to the upcoming Happiness and Its Causes Forum. It's to be held in Melbourne on the 19th and 20th of June this year. All you have to do is go to the Radio National homepage and tell us in 25 words or less what question you would ask His Holiness the Dalai Lama if you had the chance. Easy. I'll put a link to the entry page on the All in the Mind site too. Good luck. Today's sound engineer is Timothy Nicastri. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Thanks for joining me. Catch you next week. And now stay with RN for the Philosopher's Zone with Joe Gelonesi.